From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bruised and bloody Democrats caucused in Washington this week to shake off the November midterm election blues and plot a way forward. They wrapped Bush's economic policy, vowed to continue their allegiance to working families, and recalled the glorious Clinton years. But after losing both houses of Congress and the White House, Democrats are debating whether they can stick with Bill Clinton's beloved third way centrism. The combination of liberal goals and conservative respect for the bottom line won over voters, but left behind a powder keg of social problems. So Democrats are looking for another way. This hour, On Point, old Democrats' new strategies and a fourth way. We begin this hour with E.J. Dionne, columnist for The Washington Post and the senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. In his column yesterday, Dionne analyzed Louisiana Democrat Mary Landrieu's runoff campaign and victory last weekend for re-election to the U.S. Senate. Landrieu saw her party take some crushing losses in the November midterm elections, then took a tough stand against the Bush administration. And she just may have shown other Democrats how to fight back against the White House. I asked E.J. Dionne what Landrieu's victory tells Democrats about how elections are not lost, but won.
Well, I think the key thing is that Democrats, since 9/11, had lost a sense of toughness. And I think for the first 6 months after 9/11, it was completely understandable. The country was feeling very patriotic. People didn't want to undermine the president. I think what Democrats learned in November is that Republicans were willing to use even issues of national security to undermine Democratic chances. And in Mary Landrieu's case, it was particularly interesting because she had been somebody who had voted with the president on the tax cut. She was a very strong supporter of the military, and yet they were still willing to go after her. Bill Jefferson, a Democratic congressman from New Orleans, put it very well. He said Mary Landrieu really did all she could to work with this president and did all she could to reach across party lines.
And ran ads saying
so. The Republican Party still tried to come and stomp on her.
She ran ads saying she'd been on the president's team, and they still sent the president and everything else they had after her. How did she turn it around after the November midterms as she surveyed the field? What did she learn? How did she come back?
Well, what she decided to do is, instead of saying how much she supported the president, she decided to say that my opponent will be a rubber stamp for the president, and I am independent, and I am willing to oppose him on some issues. Conveniently for her, there was a report in a Mexican newspaper saying that the president was about to support a big increase in sugar imports from Mexico. We can argue about the merits of that issue, but it sure didn't help Louisiana, and she was willing to go at him on that. She was willing also to go at him on his steel protectionist policies, which hurt the port of New Orleans. In a sense, this was a kind of classic Karl Rove move, Karl Rove being the president's political guru, a way of using certain local symbolic issues to say, I'm going to run against the president on the economy. And it was the other thing she did that was very important is that she really had not done a lot of work among African-American voters in the first round, where she only got 44%. And under Louisiana's weird system, if she had gotten 50% plus one in the first round, she wouldn't have had this runoff. And so she also made a concerted effort with the African-American vote. I think this was important to Democrats in two respects. First, if they had lost this seat, you can imagine that all kinds of talk radio shows and Fox television would have been saying, aha, we are on the verge of a new Republican era.
They're on their back. They're not coming back.
Right. Mm-hmm. But the second thing is that she managed simultaneously to increase turnout among African Americans and win almost all that vote, but she also gained ground among whites in Louisiana on the economic issues. So it suggested that this party, which is given, this party being the Democrats, given to defeatism and forming circular firing squads, could suddenly contemplate, hey, there are ways of winning elections, and part of winning elections is being tough enough to confront a very tough and very partisan, intelligently partisan, but very partisan Bush administration.
So the lesson out of Louisiana, be tough, sharpen up, go after the economy, and as you say, for Democrats, it emerges that there is no percentage in making nice with this administration. They'll fight with you anyway, so fight back. Blow these lessons up to the national stage for us, E.J. Dionne. Do these play nationally, or is this a Louisiana gumbo?
It is. I mean, clearly it's Louisiana gumbo sweetened with sugar. But it does play nationally in the sense that I think after this particular election, Democrats shouldn't be as fearful as they have been in taking on the president. I think it's the case that losers allow their opponents to set the terms of the competition, winners change the terms and fight back. And I think that's what the Democrats learned here. Now, I think the Democrats have a lot of work to do. This is a party that still has a tendency to have fights between its left wings and its left wing and its centrist wing. The fact is that the Democrats are a center-left party. If the left wing and the center wing don't fly together, the bird hits the tree every single time. And I think the lesson here is that it's possible to bring these wings of the party together.
But where is the emphasis headed right now? We understand House Democrats have been caucusing in Washington this week. The debate between Democratic centrists and leftists, as you say, appears to be and have been ever since the big setbacks in the midterms very strong, very powerful. Who's winning? Are they really headed toward a coordinated policy? Are the centrists coming out on top? Are the leftists saying, we've been too centrist, it's time to get back hard left?
Well, see, I think if that's where the debate goes, the Democrats are in deep trouble. If you look back at the election, there were a lot of issues that the Democrats could have emphasized that could have appealed to their liberal wing and also appealed to centrist voters at the same time. Example one, the courts. Democrats weren't arguing to fill the courts with a bunch of leftist judges. They were simply arguing for more moderate judges and against right-wing judges. That appeals to center and left at the same time. Okay. Example two, Homeland Security. Congressman David Obey of Wisconsin has been saying, look, if you're serious about Homeland Security, there are a lot of things that need to be done, whether you're talking about strengthening our security at the ports, helping local firefighters and police men and women, to strengthen themselves. And the Bush administration has been pulling money out of that. Is that left or center? I think it's arguably both. You could list a whole bunch of issues where the Democrats can be tougher and stronger without alienating either wings of the party.
So what's coming out of the caucus this week? What do you hear on the near-term Democratic position? For example, on the economic stimulus plan that the Bush administration will be rolling out soon, where are Democrats headed? Are they going to stand up and oppose it? Are they going to go with it? What's the word?
Well, what I have heard is that the Democrats are, specifically out of this meeting, is that the Democrats have a perfectly plausible position which they could take, which is, we need short-term stimulus, which would include, for example, the possibility of a payroll tax holiday, which helps people at the lower end of the income scale, but also gives a little bit of help to people higher up, a little bit of help to the states and cities, which are really hurting in this economy, but then insisting on long-term fiscal responsibility by saying, let's freeze these tax cuts where they are, especially the tax cuts that go to the very wealthiest Americans. We're supposed to be at war. But as my friend at the Brookings Institution, where I work, likes to say, the administration seems to have the view that we're at war when it comes to domestic spending, and we're not at war when it comes to tax cuts. And I think there's an inclination on the Democratic side to call that bluff.
And longer term, are Democrats beginning to figure out of the rubble of the midterms the meaning of those midterms? What's the message that's coming to be seen as? Is there a consensus about the message of that election?
Well, I do think there's a consensus on toughness. I also think there's a need to revisit the third way. And I'm sympathetic to the third way in the sense that I think most people in center-left parties throughout the Democratic world say, okay, we're not old-fashioned, have the government take over businesses socialists. Mm-hmm. Neither are we right-wingers. And some solution ends up being in this kind of moderate center-left third way. On the other hand, I think the third way was much clearer about what it was against than what it was for. They were very good about saying we're not the old left and we're not the new right. I think the challenge now is to say what is the third way for? And I think they need a more positive and aggressive program.
Does Nancy Pelosi's victory as the House Minority Leader mean that the new definition of the third way is going to have a more left-leaning coloring to it?
You know, I think people have a tendency to look at Nancy Pelosi in almost parodied terms, that it's so easy to say, well, she's a San Francisco liberal, therefore we know everything we need to know about her. The fact is that Nancy Pelosi, allied with a very conservative congressman called Chris Cox, also from California, mm-hmm. was one of the strongest voices for human rights in China and in dictatorships around the world. Nancy Pelosi is a much more complicated figure than this parody. She is also the daughter of a mayor of Baltimore, former, you know, a late mayor of Baltimore, who is a very realistic politician. I think that Democrats made a mistake underestimating, or as he once said, misunderestimating President Bush. I think Republicans will make a similar mistake if they underestimate Pelosi and simply view her as some kind of ideologue who doesn't understand how to do politics.
I guess my point of reference is just with Representative Martin Frost, who, when he was competing for that position as House Minority Leader, sounded much more centrist, much more moderate than Nancy Pelosi.
Right. Well, I think the balance of power within the Democratic caucus in the House is to the left of center. That's different from saying it is far left of center. And I think Nancy Pelosi realizes perfectly well that if the Democrats are ever going to take back the House, and to be honest about it, it's going to be very difficult given that these congressional district lines were drawn mostly to protect incumbents. Mm-hmm. But I think she realizes perfectly well that you don't win a congressional seat in Alabama or Arkansas or Iowa in the same way that you win a congressional seat in San Francisco. I think, as I say, the key is that she is a realist about politics.
So, Dr. E.J. Dionne, as we head into tiptoe into the presidential election season, early days for 2004, how do you see the new profile of the Democratic Party emerging? If they're going to head toward a winning profile, what does it look like?
Well, the good news for the Democrats in that respect is that presidential candidates have a kind of freedom to present a national message in a way that party leaders in Congress can't quite do because they've got to organize their own members and keep a majority together. George W. Bush did a very good job of that in the 1999-2000 period, and he was able to distance himself from the Congressional Republican Party where it suited his purposes.
And be the compassionate conservative.
Right, and that was his argument. I think now we're beyond that. See, I think a fourth way was compassionate conservatism, and he's now on to a fifth way, which is a kind of national greatness security conservatism that he's hoping will realign the country. I think if you look at the field, I think John Kerry of Massachusetts has probably had the best year in terms of creating a profile of concern for national security issues linked to his service in Vietnam. He's sort of liberal enough for the liberals, but creating a certain centrist appeal on some issues like education. I think that you're going to figure out whether Al Gore runs, and I think he has also helped himself in the last couple of months simply by being tough, and I think there is a longing in the Democratic Party for being tough. I think there's a lot of concern that Gore is not the strongest candidate, but I think he's better off now than he was 6 months ago.
So a longing for toughness running throughout this analysis. E.J. Dionne, thanks for talking with us today. We'll be looking to talk with you again as it all heats up in the Democratic quarter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
E.J. Dionne is a columnist for The Washington Post and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He spoke with me earlier today from Washington. Joining me now in the studio is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, there's this theme of toughness, but we know toughness is not enough without the stuff to sell with that toughness.
Indeed, and they're playing against a tough customer, General Rove. He's got two cards that he can play against the Democrats and will be over the next year and a half. One is war. He played it this fall. They talked up the tension around Iraq, and that worked for them. They made an issue out of Homeland Defense, and that worked for them. And, you know, if there's no war this spring, I'll bet there's going to be war talk next fall as the campaign moves on. So he's got that card, and then he's got the card of taxes, where if the answer to every problem is to cut taxes, at the end of the day, there's going to be nothing in the budget for Democrats to spend. And Rove is on record as saying their overall strategy is essentially to make everybody a candidate for eager for tax cuts because government will be doing nothing for them. Starved government of service of money, can't give services. People say, relieve me from this oppressive
then
government.
Then you've got to have the tax cuts to make ends meet.
There you go.
Well, but But the Democrats have to bring cards to the table, too. We'll be talking about what those might be, what they will be. We're talking this hour about Democrats in disarray, looking for a new way. What's your suggestion for getting the Democrats back on their feet? We'll look at a fourth way tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Buyer.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at the Democratic Party's identity struggle this hour. Last week, Bill Clinton stood before the Democratic Leadership Conference, the heartland of third-way centrism, and summed up the DLC vision that had informed his administration. Here is an excerpt of that speech.
I am enormously proud to be a member of the DLC, to have been there at the beginning, to have done the work that we did between 1984 and 1992. We had a strategy rooted in new ideas based on the oldest of America's missions to constantly form a more perfect union. We implemented those ideas, AmeriCorps, the empowerment zones, community policing, charter schools, welfare reform. Going beyond false choices, we believed that we could have fiscal responsibility and social investment. We could be good for labor and business. We could grow the economy and clean the environment. We could prevent and punish crime.
That was former President Bill Clinton speaking last week before the Democratic Leadership Conference. What did Bill Clinton's centrist, or why did it? Why did Bill Clinton's centrist third way run out of steam? Was it hijacked and flipped by the compassionate conservative in the White House? Is it time for Democrats to re-embrace spending on core priorities and deficits be damned? Or is Clinton-esque fiscal conservatism still the winning formula? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Matt Miller, nationally syndicated columnist, Morning Edition commentator, and host of the public radio program Left, Right, and Center. This week, Matt's column called for the Democratic Party to look beyond the third-way centrism that worked like gangbusters in the Clinton years and urge Democrats to find a fourth way, to put some big money behind social issues. Matt Miller joins us now from Los Angeles. Good evening and welcome, Matt.
Glad to be here, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. Matt Miller, you say that the third way, the new Democrats' approach, had a fundamental flaw. It was great at winning elections, but it couldn't solve America's biggest problems. You say this as a self-described card-carrying new Democrat. So what's turning you south on the third way, Matt, and what's this fourth way you're talking about?
Well, the third way is exactly right in terms of the need to go beyond left and right. And Bill Clinton and the Democratic Leadership Council did a superb job defining that in a way that made it possible for Democrats to be competitive at the presidential level. And it really transformed the center-left around the world, as E.J. Dionne talked about earlier. Tony Blair picked up on it and others.
But if it doesn't solve social problems, that doesn't sound like much of an endorsement.
Well, no. But the problem is the affirmative part of Bill Clinton's presidency ended in 1994. And so for a decade after the Republicans won the Congress, after Clinton's health care fiasco, you recall, the problem was that Clinton didn't have the ability, both because he had to eliminate the budget deficit he inherited, and then at the end, when he had a couple of years where surpluses were emerging, his ambitions were drowned in sex scandals that sort of consumed the last couple of years. And so he never had the ability to put serious money behind the kind of initiatives in health coverage, in education, perhaps in wage subsidies for the working poor as part of welfare reform, that would have made good on the promise of third-way rhetoric. And so for 10 years, we've had a kind of a true death of public ambition because of divided government and the inability to put money behind this. So when I talk about a fourth way, what I'm really saying is it's time to admit that because President Bush has been much shrewder than Newt Gingrich and has co-opted a lot of the same centrist rhetoric and themes through his compassionate conservatism, that the only way for Democrats to not let themselves be blurred by a very savvy politician in the White House is to put money behind some of these goals. And so when I say a fourth way, it's what the third way might look like if it were actually backed by serious money. The idea would be, if I can take just a second,
please do,
is say that on health care, for example, the old left would say we've got 40 million uninsured. Most people would agree that's a national disgrace and it's wrong. The old left would say let's expand traditional programs like Medicaid. a third-way person like George Bush has become, because, in fact, rhetorically, we're all third-wayers now. He would say, and he has had a proposal since his campaign, to use tax subsidies or refundable tax credits to low-income people to enable up to 6 million of the 42 million uninsured to get health coverage.
That leaves a few uninsured.
Right. And so a fourth-way Democrat would say, look, Mr. President, we can embrace the idea of tax subsidies with some insurance market reform to make sure that people can buy policies at reasonable prices. But what about the other 36 million people?
But isn't that an awfully tall order, Matt Miller? Because what you're essentially saying is deliver where silver-tongued mega politician Bill Clinton could not. Bill Clinton delivered the third-way fiscal conservatism, but he didn't deliver for those 40 million or whatever the number was when he was in office. Who's the Democrat who's going to be more effective in standing up and doing that now?
Well, again, to be fair, Clinton tried harder than any previous president back in 93, 94 to actually enact coverage for everyone. And while his plan was overly complex, I was working in the White House at the time, while it was overly complex, it was never the socialized medicine that it was demagogued as very consciously and shrewdly by the Republicans for political gain. So I think what's encouraging in the way the debate is even shaping up now, you've got Al Gore back talking about why he thinks it's time for America to start thinking about an American version of universal health coverage. This was not where Gore was a couple of years ago during the campaign. And because of the pressure of rising health costs on business, this issue is going to be a prime example, I think, of where Democrats can distinguish themselves, because Bush will never put out a plan to cover all Americans, because you can't do that and do some other things that take money if you also want to keep cutting taxes for the best off.
So implicit,
that's a way for Democrats to not be blurred and to really make lines of distinction and mainstream what ought to be very mainstream goals, that every American ought to have basic health coverage.
It's a terrific distinction. Anybody can see it. We won't just talk about maybe covering 6 million of 40 million uninsured. We want to address the whole problem. They're all Americans. Let's look at the whole problem. But what about the spending side of this, Matt Miller? I mean, that requires enormous spending. Bill Clinton ducked that kind of spending or never got around to pulling it off. Are you saying Democrats are now, that we all live in an environment now where Democrats can stand up and say, yes, it's very expensive, and we're going to spend the money anyway because it's the right thing? Is that politically saleable?
Well, it will take, I think the answer is yes, but it's going to take a lot of public education. Here's a fact that I think people don't understand. When Presidents Reagan and Bush the first, were in the White House, federal spending as a share of the economy, or GDP, was about 22% of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
Most economists would say that's the best rough proxy for the size of government. Under Clinton, that averaged about 20% of GDP, and when he left office, it was actually under 19%, because there was economic growth, so the GDP is growing, but there was spending restraint, both because Clinton imposed it and the Republican Congress did. Bush now is actually planning, even with the defense increases and homeland security increases he's pushing, to shrink the size of government down toward 18% of GDP by the end of the decade. So this is, 2, 3, 4 points of GDP below the way government was run under a conservative icon like Ronald Reagan. In today's dollars, that's several hundred billion dollars a year, more than enough, if the debate could be framed properly, to address a lot of these unmet social needs and to pit the needs of say urban schools or the uninsured who are workers, 8 in 10 uninsured people work or in families of workers, against the continued drive to give taxes or eliminate estate taxes for what is basically 2,000 or 3,000 families.
Jack Beatty, join us. Anybody can see the need. Matt Miller's outlining the numbers. We all understand that. But if you uncork that whiskey barrel of spending, is the American electorate going to accept it? They've been tutored for a long time now, including by Bill Clinton himself, not to accept spending that was irresponsible.
Yeah, the era of big government is over. Hi, Matt Miller.
Hi, Jack.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, both sides have essentially been delegitimating the old Democratic position, which, to sum it up crudely, is we can afford many public goods together that we cannot afford alone, all by ourselves. We can't get our own education. We can't secure our own environment.
We can't build our own schools.
We can't really secure our own health because of all the myriad problems there and financing. But that idea of what we can achieve collectively that we can't singly, that has not been legitimated on the national stage for a long, long time. So I think the problem is, Matt's right, it's a problem of education, but it's also a problem of vision. Essentially telling people that the problems that we see the poor having, these problems of health care, economic insecurity, are on a continuum. We're all just a divorce or a lost job away from losing health care, away from losing economic security. And the trouble is that under Clinton and under the new Democrats, this vision got blurred by their commitment to free trade, which I'm just looking at a book, in the apparel industry alone in the Clinton years, 35% of the industry employees gone. 18% of manufacturing workers gone under the Democrats. What do you say to those apparel workers who've lost their jobs? Well, you lost your job that we could have a prosperous economy. It's a very different. In other words, the Democrats have been exposing people to economic insecurity rather than cushioning them.
Yeah, but wait a minute, Jack and Matt. Between the two of you, I'm hearing. Get rid of free trade and bring back big spending. I mean, I want you to draw the distinctions through there, Matt, but make those distinctions. How is this fourth way you're describing different from old liberal government policy? Maybe it's not, but if it is, how is it?
It is different. And let me explain a couple of ways and also address Jack's trade point. First, the way it's different, the way it's not just about more money, although more money is part of it. There are grand bargains on all these issues that need to be reached. Mm-hmm. In each of them, the left needs to be open to more market-friendly ways of achieving these traditionally progressive or liberal goals. That means on health care, for example, you're not going to get a Canadian-style single-payer health plan, nor should we want one in this country. It's not the right way to go. But if you're open to having the kind of tax subsidies to people who need it, to get cash in the hands of people who need it, mm-hmm. to buy from private plans, and over time, what it means is, with the right kind of regulation, that the insurance industry begins to look more like a regulated utility than like an industry now that tries to cherry-pick the healthiest people mm-hmm. so that it's not really providing insurance, you can achieve those goals. That's what the left needs to be open to. The right, on the other hand, has to say that if the left is going to be open to market-friendly means, then conservatives have to be willing to pony up money equal to the size of the problem. My favorite way of explaining this is that the current George Bush's health care plan is one-seventh the size of the one his father put out in 1992. People forget this, but George Bush Sr. back in 92 put out a health care plan that was very similar to the one Bill Bradley put out in 2000. Mm. When Bradley put it out at a time of huge surpluses, it was called a utopian liberal dream by the press. When Bush put it out in 92 at a time of big deficits, Democrats poo-pooed it as too little too late. They were going to get their own guy in, do it on their terms, etc. That comparison gives you a sense of how surreal public discussion is in this country and how out of whack we've got. On the trade point, just quickly,
yes.
I don't think that we should be a protectionist country. And I think Jack might consider that if we want places like Pakistan and other underdeveloped countries that we're worried about becoming breeding grounds of terrorism and fundamentalism.
Just take away the trade.
Taking away their trade in areas where they should have a competitive advantage because they've got lower wage mm-hmm. structures than we do because we're a more highly educated, advanced economy. We want them to be able to make apparel and export it to us. We want them to be in those lines of business. But Jack's point is right in the sense that it means that Democrats or the country needs to have a sturdier safety net for those who are hurt by free markets and technological advance, because without that, without health care being something that everybody knows they're going to have, no matter if their job is lost, without having some kind of decent minimum living wage that the government needs to help because you can't put it all on businesses, without those things in place, we will put at risk the free markets and technology advances that in the long run do benefit us all.
Matt, Jack, stand by. A lot of people want to join this conversation. I want to invite them in. Al's calling from Osakis, Minnesota. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Thank you. This is my first time caller, and I appreciate you taking this call.
Good to have you.
Give me a little background. I grossed a little over $100,000 a year. And by the time everything is done and time tax time comes around, after everything is over with, taxes,
yep.
all my expenses, I end up anywhere between $25,000 and $28,000 in my pocket. Okay?
Okay.
Now, I have a family of three kids. Okay?
Yeah,
we're health following. Insurance, in order to be able to, I put it like this, I can't afford a health insurance, period. It is way out of reach.
So you don't have it for you and your three children?
No, don't have it. My wife and I, we don't have it. And
right.
for somebody, when I'm grossing over $100,000 a year, don't you think that it's really sad that I'm only keeping between $25,000 and $28,000 a year?
So what do you want to tell the Democrats, Al?
Well, I tell you what. I honestly believe that this country needs health care for everybody, period, plain and simple. Because with the economy, with the amount of taxes that are brought into this country, there's no way why we can't have a health care system.
But I also hear you complaining about the tax burden. You sound like a man who might be susceptible to the Republican cry for tax cuts.
Well, I've kind of drifted away from the Democrats on that number one issue. You know, the tax cuts that they're talking about ain't going to do me a darn bit of good. That's a waste of my time, and I think it's a waste of most people's time in this country, and I don't agree with what the Republicans are doing. The bottom line is the money that you're making is not worth what it should be, period, plain and simple, and everything is going up and up and up around you. I don't know if you can follow me on what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think we've got you, and I want to put it straight to Matt Miller, because, Matt Miller, I think you've got the target of the moment here. Al is bringing $100,000. He feels like he's spending it all. It's all going right back out on taxes. He can't afford health insurance. He looks like a candidate that either Republicans or Democrats could go after. Tax cuts could be made appealing. Health coverage could certainly be made appealing. But how do you spend the extra money it's going to take to cover him, give him health coverage and not further increase that tax burden?
These are tough balancing acts, and the caller's situation in particular. If he's grossing $100,000 a year, he's in a better situation than the vast majority of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding his difficulties gives you a sense of how much
tough
tougher
it is
even further down the line. But I think it's going to mean, in part, looking at a lot of subsidies and corporate welfare and stuff we have in the tax code today that shouldn't be there, that's going to people who don't deserve it, and trying to reallocate some of this stuff. All of it's tough. I'm not saying any of this is easy, but I guess my point with where the Democrats need to go is that if they are only marginally different in what their aspirations are on some of these public goals, people are going to say, why do we need Democrats?
Mm-hmm.
And we'll never solve these big problems without stepping up to trying to mainstream these ideas of health care for everyone, of decent teachers in all schools, and some of that's going to take money, even if applied in new ways.
There's the challenge. But, Jack Beatty, while we see right now voters have gone along with George Bush saying we're willing to go into deficit for tax cuts, the question remains whether voters are willing to go into deficit for this kind of spending. That's not proven at the polls lately.
No, it isn't. And I think Al is a candidate. Boy, you talk to Karl Rove, we'll be saying, Al, you're my guy.
Have I got a tax cut for you?
Have I got a tax cut for you? I'll find one someplace, because you're exactly what I mean. You're the oppressed middle class who doesn't feel like he gets anything from the government and who pays and pays and pays. And
on the other hand, Al doesn't have health coverage.
He doesn't have health coverage. And he would, you almost want to say, well, if we can get rid of all these things you don't want, would you be willing in your taxes to pay for health coverage? But it's going to be the brave Democrat who's going to go to him and say, look, yeah, you're being assailed, you're being buried under taxes, but only pay a little more and you can get health care. That's going to be a tough one.
The world will be yours. We're talking tonight about Democrats looking for a new way, not Bill Clinton's third way, but maybe a fourth way. Why did Bill Clinton's third way run out of steam? And is it time for Democrats to re-embrace spending, big spending if necessary, on core priorities? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new fourth way for the Democratic Party. Here's another clip of Bill Clinton speaking at the Democratic Leadership Conference last week.
So I've read all the people who say that the Democratic Party is dead, but I respectfully disagree. First of all, I don't think you can underestimate the impact of the psychological shock of September the 11th on the American people. We long to be united, and we long to be strong. Secondly, they won on message, money, and turnout. The money couldn't be helped. We did the best we could. And let's not forget that in 1998, they outspent us by $100 million, and we gained seats in the House of Representatives when they thought they'd win 30. And it was the first time since 1822 that the president's party had won seats in the House in the sixth year of a presidency. And in 1822, we were a one-party country.
Bill Clinton, last week at the Democratic Leadership Conference, we're talking tonight about Democrats looking for a new way, not Bill Clinton's third way, but maybe a fourth way. That's what our guest tonight, Matt Miller, calls it. He's a nationally syndicated columnist, a Morning Edition commentator, host of the public radio program Left, Right, and Center. What do you think? If Democrats seriously step up to spend on huge national problems like 40 million uninsured, will they be winners or will they be laughed out of the House? And is deficit spending okay again? If Republicans will do it for tax cuts, can Democrats do it for daycare? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Matt Miller, when you hear the voice of Bill Clinton echoing back down the halls here, does it have the tone of the future that you see?
I actually think he remains one of the best framer of the issues and approaches that the Democrats have, and that accounts for why people still want to hear him. I still want to hear what he has to say.
Mm-hmm.
What I think the issue is how do we move forward in a way that this whole debate over should the Democrats move left or should they move center or right, I think is a false choice, which is of course the classic third way-ish spirit. The truth is we have to establish what are fundamentally goals that ought to be mainstream goals that the conservatives have been so successful at delegitimizing over the last 10 or 20 years. The idea, for example, that every American ought to have basic health coverage because they're a citizen of the country,
mm-hmm.
not because they happen to be employed by an employer who offers it and can afford it.
This week.
Ought to be something that we can agree on, that people on both left and right can agree on. And I actually think there's more ability to reach consensus on this than the typical kind of propaganda wars on either side suggests. To take another example, in urban schools, I think that the bill that President Bush touted and that Ted Kennedy was also very active in, this Leave No Child Behind Act,
mm-hmm.
will be seen very shortly to be a real hoax because without addressing what both sides have decided they agree on is that if we really talk about testing and standards and accountability, it's something that will really help improve the schools. And I think that we'll find over the next couple of years that the real problem is teacher quality, that the thing that most determines the success and student achievement of kids is how good their teachers are. And if you take big cities and compare them to their nearby suburbs, when the big cities pay less, have horrible working conditions, and much tougher to teach kids, it's no surprise that the teacher corps in big cities tends to be a mess.
So you're saying there are big problems. Democrats can win by acknowledging them, saying we all know that they're there and we've got to solve them. Here's how we'll do it. But Miller, take us back to what you describe as a kind of high watermark for Bill Clinton when he stepped up with the big health care solution, got his fingers horribly burned, and retreated. What's to prevent that kind of rise and retreat from repeating itself?
Look, you don't know that it won't repeat itself, but I'll tell you this. The example of the way the Republicans have learned from their previous missteps is very instructive. Newt Gingrich, for example, after the 94 election when he was sort of coronated as the new kind of king in Washington, mm-hmm. in the Congress, he ended up leading his party down a path that was very costly because he seemed so harsh-edged, mean, and proposed policies that were beyond the mainstream of what folks wanted to do on Medicare and the environment, et cetera. So if you look at what George Bush and Karl Rove, his political advisor, have learned from that, they went to school on that experience and are much savvier and much smarter. I think the next time the Democrats try and address these problems, they've learned that there are lessons that they can learn. Clinton himself has said many times he would do it very differently if he did health care again. Mistakes were made. That happens. It doesn't mean the goals aren't right, and it doesn't mean that you can't find a new way to do it. But it won't be through just the same old throwing money. People have to be clear on that. In each of these areas I'm talking about, Democrats need to approach it in ways that will offend some of their key constituencies. Teachers' union, labor unions, everyone's going to have to be willing to give up some traditional perk in order for the Democrats to craft an appeal that is beyond just the Democratic base, but something that independents, that conservatives and indeed the whole mainstream of the country can embrace is right for all of us.
So Jack, there's the line for the next Democratic presidential candidate. The Republicans are pretending to address all these issues. Just look around you. We can all see they're not. We're actually going to address them. Now, delivering that without scaring everybody into a tizzy about what it's going to cost seems to be the challenge in part.
Yeah, and as I say, this is all within the context of Karl Rove's second card, which is the tax cuts. If you make, you know, we're basically out of domestic spending in this country for the rest of the Bush term.
And headed further out if all these cuts go through.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that so you've got to take on those tax cuts. But that is a tough thing to do. When Ted Kennedy made some very sensible suggestions about merely postponing the day on which Bill Gates and the rest of them could get their tax cuts, he was immediately and successfully stigmatized as recommending tax increases. The vocabulary of this is very narrow. You even mention holding back taxes for the people earning $400,000 a year, and you're in favor of a tax increase.
But at least it sounds like the grist for a real debate, if some Democrat can't stand up and make a real debate out of this, it sounds like a watershed moment in the politics of this nation. What's it going to be? Each man and woman on their own bottom or some element of pulling together, that looks like a ground to stand and fight on, at least. Frank's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I just wanted to say that I think that it's not correct to suggest that the Democrats have a problem with their positions on issues or where they are on the ideological spectrum as much as they have a severe marketing problem. And unlike Republicans, they have not taken advantage of information technology, television, new media, the internet, talk radio, to get their message out and to frame it in a way that resonates with voters. And just to give you a quick example, because you mentioned the tax cuts, a poll showed that a majority of Americans believed that they would benefit from the estate tax cut, which they did not get any benefit from. But Republicans, using these media, basically mass marketed the notion that they would. And so people came to believe it, and it was untenable for Democrats to criticize the estate tax cut.
Frank, we got it. You raise a strong point. Matt Miller, you're in the media. Why are Republicans so much more effective, it seems, at pulling the kind of center of the dial in the last several years to the conservative side, to the conservative message, to the conservative talk show, you name it?
It's a great question because I think it's central to what's happened. And a couple of answers quickly. One is, I think in some sense, the conservative message is an easier sell. If you are for less taxes, less government, less regulation, boom. Everybody on that side agrees on it. It's easy to market, and it's easy to demonize things that the left or the center left wants to do. But I think this is the central challenge for Democrats now and for progressive Republicans. There's still Republicans out there who would consider themselves in the old days Rockefeller Republicans who don't like that we have these social problems and know they need to be addressed. And the question is, how are Democrats going to frame our collective goals together in ways that don't require big increases in deficits, because we shouldn't go back to that, but that are actually fundable and achievable if we can frame our goals and our ambitions in a way that ought to be mainstream and that people understand.
Matt Miller, sort that out, because you're talking in your column and tonight about big new spending. Now you're saying it doesn't mean deficits. I'm not sure I see how that adds up.
Because you're going to have to fund it. I mean, there are lots of money. For example, if I want to increase wage subsidies to the working poor, like the Earned Income Tax Credit is now, there are actually over $200 billion in earmarked programs for the poor with big bureaucracies that tend not to be as effective, and you could shift a pot of that that would go to able-bodied people. You can't move the money that's going to disabled people who can't work. But for workers, we could say, you know what? Let's go to a system where low-income, unskilled workers are subsidized so that they earn a living wage.
So do it
smarter.
That's
something that would involve a shift in money. A lot of the liberal interest groups would scream about that because you're moving money from their traditional programs. Mm-hmm. But if it's not as effective, it ought to be moved.
But do you really believe that market efficiencies are going to be enough to balance this budget if we take on all the big, difficult issues that you're laying out there?
I'm not talking about market efficiencies. I'm talking about moving money, money that is going now to programs that are less effective and moving them to, in that example, direct cash subsidies like the Earned Income Tax Credit to give people the money they need to have a decent life. On health care, it's the same thing. There are now, we spend a lot of money through the tax code subsidizing the most generous health plans for the best off people in the country, reclaiming some of that money, which now people aren't even aware of. It's kind of a hidden subsidy through the tax code. Reclaiming some of that money would go a long way to pay for insuring the uninsured. Why should we subsidize extra health coverage for people who already have decent coverage when we've got 40 million people who have none? That's the kind of logic.
Jeff's calling from Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I thought for the last two or three rounds of elections that the Democrats have missed making clear what really has been their point. And the major point has been that when times are very good, that's the time to pay down the deficit. And when times are not so good, like right now, that is indeed the time to cut taxes. I think the bottom line, a bottom line to look at between Republicans and Democrats is that the Republicans always want to cut taxes. They want to cut them at all times. And, of course, the reason is that they want a smaller government. But when President Bush said it's the taxpayers' money and we should give it back to them, the Democrats should clearly have said, well, yes, but the deficit is the taxpayers' deficit, too. It's nobody else's. And sooner or later, we have to pay it. And if we do, we're going to save 25 to 33% of your money.
Jeff, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Our time is running down. Matt Miller, we've just got 30 seconds left here. Do you see a coalescing of Democrats around a fourth way, ready to step up, talk about the big issues, and spend to solve them?
I'm an optimist. I think it's going to take some time because the Democrats won't coalesce around a spokesman until early 2004. But I think if Democrats use the next year or so very usefully and have a really soul-searching debate about what they believe in, they can head into 2004, on domestic issues at least, ready to really take defining differences to the country that funds these problems in serious ways, but not in the same old liberal way.
Matt Miller in Los Angeles, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Miller is a nationally syndicated columnist, Morning Edition commentator, and host of the public radio program Left, Right, and Center. Jack Beatty, stand by. We're going to close tonight's conversation with one more clip from Bill Clinton's speech before the Democratic Leadership Conference last week. And here he says it's time for his party to look to the future.
Martin Luther King said the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. The people who want to be the benders toward justice have the harder burden. You chose to be Democrats. Nobody made you. You made this decision. And most of us are still here because we like being here. So we lost a couple of elections. Big deal. Compared to the sacrifices others have made to be agents of constructive change, so what? So I say, take a deep breath, decide what you believe, rear back and go on.
Rear back and go on. That's not a bridge to the 21st century. We're there. It's not pretty for Democrats so far, Jack, but do you hear something brewing here?
Well, you know, he's right. Democrats have lost a couple of elections and big deal, and they lost them narrowly. You know, a spread of 90,000 votes in this last election, and the Democrats would have held on to the Senate, put it around in different states. Jane Carnahan lost by 1% in Missouri. So it isn't this big idea that there was a huge Bush rout. There wasn't a huge Bush route. They successfully used the war issue to amalgamate and to make Bush a kind of juggernaut on that issue, and they got their seats. But now they've got to govern. They've got to deliver. And Bush is facing a war that almost certainly, if he goes ahead with it, is going to at least have a short-term negative effect on his economy. And he's got the necessity of reviving the economy next year. So they've got a complicated, I say that Rove has good cards. He's got some bad ones, too.
And the Democrats have an opportunity. We'll see what they make of it. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank
good
you.
To have you in the studio. Listeners, you can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.